So the Dhamma talks I've given so far, I briefly read out what the five indriyas are: the power of faith, the power of energy, power of mindfulness, the power of concentration, and the power of wisdom, or the faculty anyway. Sometimes they're also called the powers. It's basically the same five things. So I'd like to read a couple more suttas. I gave my own sort of brief personal definitions of these five things earlier, kind of how I understood them. And let's see how the Buddha defines each of them. Now this is Anguttara Nikaya 5.15. So the indriyas are mentioned outside of the Samyutta as well. Here's an example of that. Okay, so when I say power of this, power of that, it's interchangeable with faculty of this, faculty of that. And there is a sutta which equates the two. You can say faculty and power, they're kind of the same thing. That sutta is Samyutta Nikaya 48.43, although I won't read it out. But I just want to note the place where the Buddha effectively equates them. Okay. Alright, so back to these definitions as the Buddha defines them. Bhikkhus, there are these five powers. What five? The power of faith, the power of energy, the power of mindfulness, the power of concentration, and the power of wisdom. And where, bhikkhus, is the power of faith to be seen? The power of faith is to be seen in the four factors of stream entry. And where is the power of energy to be seen? The power of energy is to be seen in the four right strivings. And where is the power of mindfulness to be seen? The power of mindfulness is to be seen in the four establishments of mindfulness, or four foundations of mindfulness. And where is the power of concentration to be seen? The power of concentration is to be seen in the four jhanas. And where is the power of wisdom to be seen? The power of wisdom is to be seen in the four noble truths. These bhikkhus are the five powers. Okay, so finally we're getting some definitions here, you know, for each of these five things. It might feel a little frustrating to hear this because it's like, well, okay, you mentioned the four factors of stream entry, but, you know, what are those, you know? You just kind of ran past them there without really listing them. Okay, fair. There's another sutta where he does expand those things a little more. Okay. Samyutta Nikaya 48.10. Bhikkhus, there are these five faculties. What five? The faculty of faith, the faculty of energy, the faculty of mindfulness, the faculty of concentration, and the faculty of wisdom. And what, bhikkhus, is the faculty of faith? Here, bhikkhus, the noble disciple is a person of faith, one who places faith in the enlightenment of the Tathagata thus. And then there's kind of a long list of, it's basically from the Itipiso, you know, the Blessed One is a bunch of qualities from the Itipiso, teacher of devas and humans, the enlightened one, the Blessed One. Okay, the Pali right beside is like, Iti viso bhagava arahang samma sambuddho vija charana sampano sugato. That's the basic qualities of the Buddha. Okay, and from the last sutta, you heard me say it's the four things qualifying one for a sotapanna. A confirmed faith in the Buddha, confirmed faith in the Dhamma, confirmed faith in the Sangha. And the fourth thing is usually morality, which is, praiseworthy by the noble ones. Like, praised by the noble ones, it's morality which is, good sila. It is unmottled and unblotched and unstained and isn't bad sila. Okay? By the way, that fourth item can change in a few of the suttas. It isn't always good sila. But the first three things are always confirmed faith in the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha. Okay. So moving on to the next entry here. And what, bhikkhus, is the faculty of energy? Here, bhikkhus, the noble disciple dwells with energy aroused for the abandoning of wholesome states and the acquisition of wholesome states. He is strong, firm in exertion, not shirking the responsibility of cultivating wholesome states. He generates desire for the non-arising of unarisen evil unwholesome states. He makes an effort, arouses energy, applies his mind, and strives. He generates desire for the abandoning of arisen evil unwholesome states. He makes an effort, arouses energy, applies his mind, and strives. He generates desire for the arising of unarisen wholesome states. He makes an effort, arouses energy, applies his mind, and strives. He generates desire for the maintenance of arisen wholesome states, for their non-decay, increase, expansion, and fulfillment by development. He makes an effort, arouses energy, applies his mind, and strives. This is called the faculty of energy. Okay, so you may recognize this all as the four right efforts. The four right efforts. And the way I like to summarize those four right efforts, it's avoiding, overcoming, developing, and maintaining. Avoiding, overcoming, developing, and maintaining. Had you been here on my last meditation retreat I did in March, a few of you were there. The theme of that retreat was the four right efforts. And I did record the talks, and I did put them on my website too. So if you'd like to hear more about the four right efforts, I have talks on that, and there's sutra references and everything too. I'm one of those monks who's kind of fussy about sutra references. Yeah, like, which sutra said what? Most of the monks you meet, most of the monks I've met anyway, the way that they cite references, they just state the Pali name of the reference. They'll just say, oh, that's in the Aniruddha Sutta. And you're like, well, where was that? That could be anywhere in a stack of books this tall. Where's that? Well, they don't tell you. It's up to you to figure out where that is. But when I give a reference, it's like, no, that's Samyutta Nikaya 48.43, And there's a website where you can actually just punch that in. SN space 48.43, enter. And it takes you to that sutta. Bam. Yeah. There's a really good sutta lookup tool on the web now. I use it a lot. So we Westerner style monks tend to use that notation, Like, it's much shorter, it's much more... when you say something like Aniruddha Sutta, well, what were the Pali diacritics there, The diacritics are like those bars above the A and the dot under the T, and, that funny kind of punctuation, that's called the diacritics. And sometimes you have to get those diacritics perfect if you're going to do a search. Sometimes the consonants, there's two of them, or maybe there's an H in there, someone may not have aspirated the H. Aspirate means like making an H sound. So it's much harder to look up the suttas when they just say the name of it that way. Okay. All right, so four right efforts. Okay, so let's move on now to the third indriya. And what, bhikkhus, is the faculty of mindfulness? Here, bhikkhus, the noble disciple is mindful, possessing supreme mindfulness and discretion. One who remembers and recollects what was done and said long ago. He dwells contemplating the body in the body, feelings in feelings, mind in mind, phenomena in phenomena, ardent, clearly comprehending, and mindful, having removed covetousness and displeasure in regard to the world. This is called the faculty of mindfulness. Okay, so that was just the four foundations of mindfulness there. Body in the body, feelings in feelings, mind in mind, and phenomena in phenomena. So again, the Buddha is referring to another list of Dhamma here that's actually quite big, without really expanding on it. Maybe I will expand on it in a further, a subsequent Dhamma talk here. In Majjhima Nikaya 118, the Anapanasati Sutta, that's a famous sutta where the four foundations of mindfulness are listed in full. And it's pretty long, it's not that long. It's about four paragraphs. Yeah, maybe I'll read it. It's only four big paragraphs here. Okay. Alright, so these are the four foundations of mindfulness. Let's just shove that in there before I continue on. Okay. And how, bhikkhus, does mindfulness of breathing, developed and cultivated, fulfill the four foundations of mindfulness? Bhikkhus, on whatever occasion a bhikkhu, breathing in long, understands, I breathe in long. Or, breathing out long, understands, I breathe out long. Breathing in short, understands, I breathe in short. Or breathing out short, understands, I breathe out short. Trains thus, I shall breathe in, experiencing the whole body of breath. Different monks will translate this passage differently. There's room for interpretation around this phrase here. I shall breathe in, experiencing the whole body of breath. Trains thus, I shall breathe out, experiencing the whole body of breath. Trains thus, I shall breathe in, tranquilizing the bodily formation. Trains thus, I shall breathe out, tranquilizing the bodily formation. On that occasion, a bhikkhu abides contemplating the body as a body, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. I say that this is a certain body among the bodies, namely, in breathing and out breathing. That is why, on that occasion, a bhikkhu abides contemplating the body as a body, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. I've heard so many Dhamma talks about this sutta. Even though it's a long sutta and says a lot of things, there's a lot of places in the sutta where there just isn't all that much detail given when we might wish for more detail, okay? Like, there's a phrase here that went flying by. Having put away covetousness and grief for the world. Okay? That just kind of went flying by. But I would argue, if I had a highlighter, I would highlight that on the screen of my iPad, okay? That's a very heavy statement right there, okay? Remember last night I was giving you this analogy of a juggler, okay? My own little analogy here. So let's say we give the juggler two balls to juggle, and it's too easy. That is comparable to somebody who is doing an object of meditation which doesn't fully occupy their mind. Let's say they're doing mindfulness of breathing, but they also have some mind chatter off to the side. Their mind's kind of chattering in addition to watching the breath. They are watching the breath, but it's not keeping them fully occupied. Okay? I say that person has not put away covetousness and grief for the world. That bit of extra chatter on the side has not been put away, okay? Has not been put aside. Okay, so now we give our juggler three balls to juggle. And they can do it just barely, okay? That's the extent of their juggling talent. They can do three. But if you ask them to tell a joke in addition to the three, they couldn't do that at the same time. They would drop the balls. Okay, they got to give it all their attention. Then they can do three. Or they couldn't ride a skateboard at the same time and juggle three balls. It'd be too much. Okay? All right, now if you ask them to juggle four balls, no, they can't do that. That's too much. They drop them on the ground. Okay, so trying to juggle the four balls, that I say is comparable to choosing an object of meditation which is too ambitious. It's too much. Okay? Maybe once you've meditated for, I don't know, 5, 10, 15, 20 years, your talent will increase. Your skill will increase. And you can juggle, let's say, four balls. Or even maybe five or six. You might become like an elite juggler who can juggle more. However, when we want to enter the jhanas, and we know we're going to need stillness of mind to get there. Okay? We know we're going to need stability of mind to get there. We know we are going to need kind of like stable, still. What was my third word with an S? Anyway, stable and still. And this putting aside of covetousness and grief has to be done, I say. And I say by picking object of meditation that keeps us nicely occupied, we don't have any extra capacity of the mind to do any of that chattering on the side. Okay? So to my mind, that is the most important bit being said here in this sutta, is you have to put aside covetousness and grief, and you have to pick an object of meditation which takes you there. At the start of this paragraph, I was talking about breathing in long and short, but by the end of the paragraph, now it's talking about abides contemplating the body as a body, ardent, fully aware. Hey, in the very same paragraph, we went from breath to body, didn't we? Two different objects of meditation are mentioned there, aren't they? Gee, it sure looks to me like it's okay to mix them. Look, this very same paragraph has the two of them. If anybody tells you, no, you only can do one at a time, I say, have you read the Anapanasati Sutta? Okay, next paragraph. Bhikkhus, on whatever occasion a bhikkhu trains thus, I shall breathe in, experiencing rapture, trains thus. I shall breathe out, experiencing rapture, trains thus. I shall breathe in, experiencing pleasure, trains thus. I shall breathe out, experiencing pleasure, trains thus. I shall breathe in, experiencing mental formation, trains thus. There's a lot of repetition here. Okay, so lots of breathing in and out, experiencing different things. And at the end of each paragraph, and that is why on that occasion a bhikkhu abides contemplating mind as mind, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. Okay, each of these paragraphs ends with that same sentence. Having put away covetousness and grief for the world, okay? So it gives like a big long list of things you can be mindful of. And puts away covetousness and grief for the world. Okay? Lists a whole bunch of things to be mindful of and puts away covetousness and greed for the world. Lists a bunch of things to be mindful of and puts away covetousness and greed for the world. You see? Now, a lot of the teachers I've heard teach this sutta, they get very hung up on the list of things to be mindful of. But what I wish to draw attention to here and emphasize is, look at how that phrase at the end gets repeated over and over. Puts aside covetousness and greed for the world. Okay? So that's why I say we need to be like the juggler who juggles enough balls that there's no extra capacity. You can't tell a joke on the side. You can't ride a skateboard on the side. You can't do anything on the side. You are totally occupied with that object of meditation. Okay? So if you're wondering, where does the Venerable Subro get these weird ideas? Well, here's where I get it, okay? Now, every monk you meet is going to read this sutta and perhaps draw out some theme different sounding than mine. Perhaps they, you know, really latched onto something and really developed it, and it really helped them, and maybe they broke through the jhanas or even attained nibbana. Okay? And I say awesome. I feel, you know, suttas like this, there's so much there, and there's a lot of opportunity to find something that helps. Okay, no matter what kind of person you are, there's something here for you, pretty much. But where I would just sort of make a gentle distinction is if somebody pulls out a different lesson out of this sutta than you, please don't get upset by that. Don't get offended or affronted that they pulled out a lesson different than the one you, you know, benefited from. Okay. Alright, so so I'm not going to read this whole thing, but I do wish to point out the pattern of how each of those four paragraphs end in put away covetousness and greed for the world. It's as though the Buddha is really like really kind of hammering on that point over and over again. Alright, it's in there. All four paragraphs. Okay. Now let's go back. Alright, so we took a detour to look into these four foundations of mindfulness. Even in this sutta, okay, after listing them, ardent, clearly comprehending, mindful, having removed covetousness and displeasure in regard to the world. This is called the faculty of mindfulness. Okay, so that's in here. Okay, now moving on to the fourth indriya. And what, bhikkhus, is the faculty of concentration? Here, bhikkhus, the noble disciple gains concentration, gains one-pointedness of mind, having made release the object. Okay, so now what I said earlier to you many times is like, you know, what object of meditation can you do? It keeps your mindfulness rolling. You know, keeps your mindfulness as steady as you can manage. And then if some sort of peace arises, okay, good, good. Now you're getting it. Now you're going somewhere. I feel that is equivalent to this statement. Having made release the object. Release here would be like the peacefulness, you know, the samadhi, the brahmiharas. This word release is synonymous with, you know, attaining to one of these higher states. It's like release of the mind, release of the heart. Okay. Here because the noble disciple gains concentration, gains one-pointedness of mind, having made release the object. Secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, he enters and dwells in the first jhana, which is accompanied by thought and examination, with rapture and happiness born of seclusion. With the subsiding of thought and examination, he enters and dwells in the second jhana, which has internal confidence and unification of mind, is without thought and examination, and has rapture and happiness born of concentration. With the fading away as well of rapture, he dwells equanimous and, mindful and clearly comprehending, he experiences happiness with the body. He enters and dwells in the third jhana, of which the noble ones declare, he is equanimous, mindful, one who dwells happily. With the abandoning of pleasure and pain, and with the previous passing away of joy and displeasure, he enters and dwells in the fourth jhana, which is neither painful nor pleasant, and includes the purification of mindfulness by equanimity. This is called the faculty of concentration. Okay, so this is kind of like a stock reading of the first four jhanas. These exact words are in the suttas many, many times. Can I get you to save the question to the end? Okay, now I do want to dwell here a little bit. So, in my role teaching this retreat, one of the more difficult parts of this role is when people on the retreat, bless their hearts, they do their meditation well, and they attain to some sort of deep state, they feel the bliss, they really have some awesome, transcendent, amazing, okay, out of this world, heavenly experience. And yeah, when that happens, that's awesome. That's like, it's kind of like a conversion experience. Like, wow, this is, the Buddha was not kidding. This is awesome. I love this. I want to be Buddhist. It's like a conversion experience to Buddhism because it can impact you so deeply, emotionally. Okay? And I don't want to in any way cast any doubt on that or any sense of criticism on that experience. How you experienced it, that happened. It's not a dream, okay? And don't let anybody ever take that away from you, that ever happened. Never forget it. Okay, now here's where the frustration is on my part. So if the person comes to me and they're like, okay, I experienced this, it felt like that, I did this object meditation and it felt like this. It's very hard when you are kind of listening in from the outside, and they're curious, what was that? Was that the first jhana or maybe the second or third or, what did I attain there, And I gotta admit, I don't have the psychic power to, have reached into your mind and experienced it, psychically along with you, okay? I believe such monks do exist, by the way, and nuns. But alas, I'm not one of them. Now, and they can tell you what that was, actually. Although, they oftentimes won't really tell you directly. They will oftentimes just drop little hints as to what they thought it was. And they're sort of, there is a kind of a street smarts to doing that. They're not supposed to reveal psychic powers. Remember my example with Pindola yesterday? Pindola ruined it all for all of us here. So Pindola made a big mistake there where the Buddha banned the monks and nuns from revealing psychic powers. So they'll drop hints, perhaps, if you're lucky. And now, just because somebody, by the way, can attain samadhi, what remains to be seen is, are they able to maintain a standard of sila from that time on? Like, for the rest of their life, can they have very pure sila? And by the way, you need very pure sila to even so much as be acknowledged as a sotapanna. Okay, so someone might be able to attain samadhi today, But next week, they're kind of being unwise with their morality. So if some monk vetted them and, you know, spoke on their behalf, you know, kind of, oh, you attained this, you attained that, kind of certifying them almost, you know, then if they do something bad later on, now the monk regrets that endorsement. I shouldn't have endorsed this person. Now they made me look embarrassed because they behave badly. Okay, so it's a risky thing to endorse somebody's attainment. That's what I'm saying. Because you don't know what their morality is going to look like later on. Okay, so that's weird thing number one about telling other people what their attainments are. Okay, like first of all, monks and nuns shouldn't use psychic powers. Number two, there's a risk involved with endorsing somebody. Even the Buddha admits that he has to get to know somebody over a long period of time and watch their behavior in a number of situations with different types of people, etc. Only after a long time of really observing them will he dare to conclude they're an arahant. The Buddha can't just look at some monk he's never really even met before. Oh yeah, that's an arahant. Or no, he's not an arahant. The Buddha does not jump to those conclusions. There is a place where he admits to a king. He has to get to know somebody for a long time and observe their behavior for a long time. I think it's in the Udana somewhere. I did a Dhamma talk on this not too long ago. If you want the reference, I can get it. I'm almost positive it's in the Udana. Yeah, but we can talk after. Okay, so that's when you come to someone wanting to know what your attainments are, just be aware that you're not too likely to get a real nice straight answer, you know, like, oh, let me shake your hand, because that was the third jhana, or, you know, you're almost certainly not going to get an answer back like that, okay? But here's what I can tell you, okay? Now, there's something much better than nothing here. Now, remember when we went from the first jhana to the second jhana, okay? So with the first jhana, it is accompanied with thought and examination, okay? And with the subsiding of thought and examination, he enters and dwells in the second jhana. Is without thought and examination, okay? So here is something we can actually go by. If you had some super blissful, powerful, you know, experience, and not just for a second or two, you know, like 20 minutes, 30 minutes, 40 minutes, should be nice and long. If your mind was silent, like, I mean, there was no chatter at all, no words, no inner voice, okay? Your inner voice shut up for a change. And it normally never shuts up all day long, okay? As we have been rather uncomfortably discovering these last couple of days, okay? Once you get into the second jhana, your mind shuts up for the... Finally, there's this long break. It's just silent. Okay? So from the second jhana and up, you get that silence. Like, the mind is like in park. There is no chatter. With the first jhana, there can be a little bit of chatter. But then one can notice, oh no, this chatter is starting to... kind of like taint the experience, you know, like the bliss might start fading along with the chatter. And then one's like, oh, I better not pay attention to that chatter. You know, this is weakening. This experience is weakening. So one pays attention to the object of meditation again. Let's say the breath or the body, whatever you're doing. You kind of go back to your object of meditation and don't pay attention to the chatter. Then that bliss can flare back up again. But the chatter, again, comes and annoys you. And then it begins to weaken. Uh-oh, I got to pay attention to my object of meditation again. The breath or the body or whatever. And then the chatter subsides again. You know? So there's this wobbling where it's like surges of bliss. But then the chatter starts to threaten the bliss and weaken it. Oh, but then you go back to your object. Oh, and then the bliss swells up again. So it's like swelling and fading a bit. Swelling and fading a bit. And you can't quite defeat this chatter, you know? It's like you're almost breaking free of that chatter. And then once you're in the second jhana, now the chatter leaves you alone. Now the chatter shuts up. Okay? So that is a nice dotted line that we can trust, where no matter how much bliss you have, if there's some chatter on the side, what you can know for sure is you did not get to the second jhana or above. If there's still some chatter, even a bit on the side, then it's going to be the first jhana or below. Okay, and when I say below, I'm talking about there's also Brahma Viharas, you know, equanimity, mudita, karuna, metta. So those would be kind of below the first jhana. Okay, now, so that is a nice dotted line for us where you don't need any monk or nun to certify this for you or whatever, okay? So I just thought I'd dwell there. Now, there are a bunch of different signs spoken of here and there in the suttas. I won't get into them right here. You know, this jhana has these signs and that jhana has those signs and characteristics and whatnot. Okay, but let's move on here to the fifth indriya. Okay, and what, bhikkhus, is the faculty of wisdom? Here, bhikkhus, the noble disciple is wise. He possesses wisdom directed to arising and passing away, which is noble and penetrative, leading to the complete destruction of suffering. He understands as it really is. This is suffering. He understands as it really is. This is the origin of suffering. He understands as it really is. This is the cessation of suffering. He understands as it really is. This is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. This is called the faculty of wisdom. Okay, these bhikkhus are the five faculties. Okay, so you probably just noticed there that was the Four Noble Truths. Okay, this is suffering. This is the origin of suffering. This is the cessation of suffering. And this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. Okay, so here's one of those places in the suttas where it's like within one list of Dhamma, we are referred to another list of Dhamma. Okay? We went from the five indriyas and we got kind of referred over to the Four Noble Truths. Okay, now if we were to examine the Four Noble Truths, that last one, this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering, that too refers to another list of Dhamma. Okay, it's the Eightfold Path. You see? So there's this pattern you find in the suttas sometimes where, you know, you study these lists of Dhammas. Sometimes the lists lead you to other lists. Okay? You just kind of go on this trip around into these different lists. You know, this is a good way to teach these lessons, to teach these lists of Dhamma. They kind of refer to each other, they link up to each other.